Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Samuel Sternberg, renowned expert on the leading edge of CRISPR gene editing technology and co-author of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution, which examines the limitless potential of this emerging approach to editing DNA. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. And you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please feel free to leave us a review. Now, stay tuned for our interview with CRISPR expert Dr. Samuel Sternberg on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Samuel Sternberg, PhD biochemist and internationally renowned expert on CRISPR gene editing technology. Dr. Sternberg is an assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biophysics at Columbia University, where he also runs a research lab developing new tools for advancing genome engineering technology. He earned his PhD in chemistry from the University of California, Berkeley, under the mentorship of Dr. Jennifer Doudna, co-creator of the CRISPR technology for genome editing. He's also written extensively as an expert on the subject, including co-writing with Dr. Doudna, A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing, and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. Dr. Sternberg, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great to be with you.
You know, Sam, CRISPR technology has brought us to the brink of unprecedented potential for scientific breakthroughs. But as you say in the title of your book, A Crack in Creation, gene editing also holds the unthinkable power to control evolution and even change the course of it. You're one of a small cadre of scientists who are on the leading edge of this technology. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners just how vast the potential is, and conversely, the possible Pandora's box of harm that could be unleashed with CRISPR-Cas9.
Well, I don't think the risk of harm is that great, actually. I mean, I think the potential to do good in the world is unprecedented because, you know, for so long we've been limited by relying on natural random mutations as a way of being, you know, the work stuff of evolution. And now with tools like CRISPR, scientists have the capability to go into the genome, which is made up of DNA and virtually all living organisms on our planet, and make pinpointed precision changes to that genetic material. And so that could really change the way that scientists think about treating disease in human patients, in editing the DNA of plants and animals that we rely on for food and other kinds of industrial biotechnology. You know, already we've seen a complete transformation of the way that biomedical research is being done because of the ability to now go into the genome and make changes as a way of designing better experiments to understand things like the way that cancerous cells proliferate, how we can design better drugs to target those cells, and really virtually any sector of biological research can be now studied better with tools like CRISPR.
Sam, in your book and in your many speeches around the world on CRISPR technology, you start by asking the question, what if it were as easy to edit faulty genes in our DNA as it is to fix a typo in Microsoft Word, which might be the most provocative sentence I've heard all year. But you said that's exactly what CRISPR-Cas9 technology has the potential to do. It's fast by most research standards, and it's efficient. So the million-dollar question for our listeners, I think, is can you help them understand exactly how CRISPR works to achieve these dramatic results?
That is a million-dollar question. Let's see. I'll take a stab at it. Yeah, you know, CRISPR is often described as a pair of molecular scissors that runs based on a pair of GPS coordinates provided by a molecule called RNA or ribonucleic acid. But the general premise is we have a way of cutting DNA in defined locations and then repairing that broken DNA using repair mechanisms that cells are very good at doing. So basically, we can deliver CRISPR molecules into the cells we'd like to edit and program the CRISPR molecules in a way that we can edit the gene that we might be interested in studying or in repairing. And I always like to stress the fact that, you know, CRISPR was certainly invented as a technology, but it actually draws its inspiration from something that exists in nature all around us. CRISPR comes from a very natural immune system that we discovered in bacteria. And so, the beauty of the story of CRISPR's discovery is that it kind of came out of this decades-long struggle to understand what these funky CRISPR molecules are even doing in nature. And once we and others had solved that problem, it became very clear how we could harness those same biomolecules for this kind of molecular scissors cut-and-paste functionality in human cells, in plant cells, animal cells, pretty much any cell type or organism you can think of. Studying in the laboratory has now been edited with CRISPR technology.
You know, so you can do it on one cell. I think the question is, how do you spread it to the billions of cells that might be in the body to effectuate change? So maybe walk through, don't get too sciencey on us for the lay listener, but how does it scale up in the body and what techniques are out there to spread it to a billion cells?
Yes, that's going to be the big question and the big hurdle in realizing this potential for harnessing CRISPR as a therapeutic tool for treating disease. Because you can't really spread it. I mean, you have to actually deliver CRISPR into every cell you'd like to edit. It's not going to spread on its own unless you can edit stem cells inside the body. So actually, we can start with disorders of the bloodstream, which are some of the first that are being tackled, because it's possible to edit cells that are blood stem cells, meaning if you edit just a small number of blood stem cells, those will be immortalized in the body, and so those will end up proliferating and turning into cells like red blood cells, where disorders such as beta thalassemia or sickle cell disease have their greatest effect. So one type of therapy, if you were targeting these blood diseases, would be editing blood stem cells in the laboratory. You can actually remove those cells from patients, repair the causative mutation in the lab, and then return those edited stem cells back into the patient's bone marrow. And this would now give that patient a new reservoir of stem cells from which healthy blood cells could be produced for the remainder of that patient's lifetime. So that's kind of one of the lower hanging fruit type indications because of this ability to edit stem cells. When you talk about now neurological diseases, diseases that affect organs like the heart or the lungs, now we have a much greater challenge because those therapies will need to be delivered directly into the patient's body in a way that can target many, many different cells of a given tissue type or organ. And so, researchers are looking at using different kinds of viral vectors, retooled viruses to try to spread those CRISPR molecules into as many cells as possible in the patient. But as you can imagine, this is going to be very, very difficult. And I think, there's right now a big gap between how easy it's become to do this cut and paste in the laboratory in cultured cells versus transforming this into a therapy that's going to work in living patients.
You know, I have something similar to the feeling that I had when I learned that we had completed the full mapping of the Human Genome Project, which was something like the way I felt when we saw the first step on the moon, just huge, big, kind of world-changing events. And all these achievements come about through collaboration. And in this case, with the Human Genome Project, really a pretty global collaboration among thousands of scientists working together. There's always an element of competition in discovery. And I understand there's been some competition between the labs, including Dr. Dowden's lab at Berkeley and another group at MIT. And it's relevant mostly in terms of this issue of patent rights. So as scientists around the world work to apply CRISPR technology to new protocols, how do you find the right balance between collaboration, which will advance the science faster, presumably, and competition in this really very new and emerging body of science?
Well, I think there are very few people I can think of that are holding onto knowledge as opposed to making sure it's out in the open. And even with this ongoing patent dispute, any researcher in the world that wants to be using CRISPR can actually go to a non-for-profit company called Adgene and obtain the resources they need for just $60 to start developing CRISPR tools in their own laboratory. So I actually think, there really hasn't been any negative impact of this intellectual property generation on the development of basic research applications of CRISPR. And I think the collaboration is something we can celebrate here. So even the work that came in after Jennifer's lab, that was actually a very productive and enjoyable collaboration between Jennifer and Emmanuel Charpentier, who's now leading a Max Planck Institute in Germany. You know, Feng Zhang's lab at MIT has done incredible work. And I think, you know, what's really exciting for someone like myself, who's been a researcher starting as a PhD student, then working at a biotech company, now starting my own lab, is seeing new discoveries coming out every day in scientific journals, meeting people at conferences, brainstorming together. You know, I think it's exciting that many people are working in this space. That leads to some practical challenges in terms of what questions can I go after that aren't already being pursued elsewhere. But I think at the end of the day, it's just exciting to have so many different brilliant minds focusing on this problem and thinking creatively about how to develop the technology quicker, better, faster, and how to start realizing some of these lofty goals that I think are going to be made possible with CRISPR.
We're speaking today with Samuel Sternberg, PhD, biochemist and internationally renowned expert on CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology. He is assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biophysics at Columbia University, where he also runs a research lab aimed at developing new tools for advancing genome engineering. He is the co-author, along with CRISPR co-creator Jennifer Doudna, a crack in creation, gene editing, and the unthinkable power to control evolution. Sam, this technology does not come without some controversy. It's also being, as you've described it, engaged in across the globe. And the pace of experimentation is exceeding the scientific community's ability to set reliable ethical guidelines in place. I know the Chinese scientists, there's some fear about doing experiments on embryos, leading to fears of baby engineering and other liberties being taken in the human biology. Recently, it was reported that some CRISPR experiments unleashed an uncontrolled chain reaction. How founded are some of these fears, and where do you see this science becoming potentially dangerous, and how do we mitigate the threat?
You know, I think there's a couple different facets of what you just brought up that are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but pretty separate. So maybe the last thing you mentioned is these unintended effects of CRISPR, or, you know, some of these genomic events that CRISPR can cause that are often not what scientists are attempting to do. So there's a major body of research right now aimed at making sure CRISPR can be developed as safely as possible, and that if you are using CRISPR to, let's say, repair a genetic mutation, that we really understand exactly what's happening at the cellular and at the DNA level when CRISPR goes in and makes that edit. And I think we're still learning, and there's been a couple high-profile papers in the last few months, that there are some risks associated with making edits to the genome, which can involve either making additional mutations elsewhere in the genome at unintended sites, or even the edits being something that can't be easily controlled. And instead of changing a T to a G, you might make that change in 80% of the cells, but have 5% of the cells where you accidentally deleted a whole big chunk of the gene that you're trying to repair. So I think in terms of safely deploying CRISPR in various contexts, whether it's human therapeutics or as an agricultural or a research tool, you know, we're still learning how to best use this tool and use it in a way that's safe and predictable. And then we can talk certainly about the other very controversial aspect of CRISPR, which is, you know, actually where, what kinds of cells, what kinds of organisms could we use it in? And we've been talking a little bit about using it to treat disease in living human patients. But as you mentioned, researchers have also shown that it can be delivered into human embryos as a way of installing genetic changes at the earliest point in sexual reproduction and development. And so that, you know, brings about this kind of futuristic scenario where, you know, might parents use a tool like CRISPR in the context of an in vitro fertilization clinic to make designer changes to their future children. That's something that is no longer purely the stuff of science fiction, because tools like CRISPR now make that, in theory, practical and feasible. And so there's a growing body of researchers, of ethicists, of regulators, of religious leaders who are grappling with this question of what kinds of applications should we really be pursuing with this technology.
You know, we in healthcare have the opportunity to be so saddened by the really devastating diseases and conditions that families experience in the realm of inherited diseases, cystic fibrosis and sickle cell, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and certainly Alzheimer's and Huntington's. We now think of, or Huntington's, we've always thought of that, Alzheimer's, we now think of that some way, the connection between the BRCA gene and breast and ovarian cancers. You've really laid out the potential for upending the whole approach to disease cures and possibly even prevention with CRISPR technology. Talk about a few of the dramatic discoveries being made in this short period of time and how soon you see this having an impact on actually treating and preventing some of the most dreaded diseases.
Well, I think for just about all of the diseases you just mentioned, there have been multiple publications already showing that CRISPR can repair the mutations associated with those diseases. So in terms of the core technological platform to make these changes in cells that we culture in the laboratory, CRISPR's been proven to be effective at doing that. In terms of these yielding real therapies that work in patients, that comes back to these challenges about delivery, about safety, about how to introduce CRISPR into the body. And so I think it's still going to be many years until we see therapies making their way through clinical trials when we can really answer the question, are these going to be effective for patients living with disease today? I will say that there's been one area of therapeutics where CRISPR is already being tested, and that's in the treatment of cancer, where CRISPR is used to engineer immune cells in an area of cancer therapy called cancer immunotherapy, whereby patients' own immune cells can be engineered to become better at hunting down cancer cells in the body. So I think that might be one of the areas where we see the first commercialized drugs that use CRISPR as a way of engineering the genome in cells being used as the main mode of this therapy. And so those clinical trials have begun in China. There's a number of different trials that are already ongoing, and they haven't yet begun in the U.S., but I believe they're slated to begin later this year for skin cancer, if I'm not mistaken. So I think cancer immunotherapy is where we might see therapies come the quickest, but many of those other diseases, it's going to be a matter of taking these proof of concept experimental successes and transitioning them into clinical trials that are tested on patients.
Well, with such excitement around the new technologies that CRISPR potentially offers, obviously there's been lots of interest in making investments. And then one starts to think about what the cost will be. And while you say that developing the CRISPR interventions is actually quite affordable by scientific research standards, cost often escalates. How do you envision the cost of these highly personalized approaches impacting the healthcare industry? And as we move forward with CRISPR-aided interventions, we're still at the what sounds like the earlier stage of this, but how do you see this intersection of that venture capital we talked about with the ultimate cost of any therapies that get developed?
Yeah, that's something I struggle with, and I guess your listeners will be experts in healthcare. That's something I don't know a lot about beyond the fact that it's extremely expensive, and certainly when you move towards personalized therapies, the price is going to go even higher than drugs that are going to be broadly effective. I mean, I'd like to think that while the initial therapies are going to be very expensive, you know, that's hopefully just one time point on a path towards the core technology becoming better and the kind of workflows to make those therapies becoming more entrenched such that over time the cost will go down. I can't really speak to how that's going to be possible, but I think we got to start somewhere and hopefully we'll get there.
Well, one thing that seems really clear to me is that all this is going to have quite a profound effect on how we educate and train the next generation of healthcare professionals and the research scientists. And I'm curious, is there much talk yet about how this really is going to change the education of both the clinical people, physicians and nurses and genetic counselors, even those of us in primary care then have to be sort of educated to a whole new special area of talking with patients about what we assume at some point will be a different level of screening and mapping. But what changes to education are going to be needed?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that's been pretty amazing for me to experience is going and giving some talks and having high school students come up to me afterwards and not just say they know what CRISPR is, but they've actually done CRISPR experiments in high school in their biology laboratories. So I think that gives you a sense for how quickly this technology has spread beyond the confines of PhD and postdoctoral level research into, you know, back down to high school, certainly to the undergraduate level, and I think increasingly into the healthcare arena. I think the impact for patients, that will take much longer to come about. But, you know, tools like CRISPR and other gene editing approaches, I think they've already transformed the way that we think about how we can study the genome. You cannot really be a biologist today and be maximally successful if you don't have an understanding of how these technologies work, because it's really changing the way that we can think about designing experiments. And maybe in 10, 20 years, it's going to change the way that we need to think about how to treat disease. You know, I think maybe the dream is that we'll be able to say goodbye to the days when a genetic disease had to always be treated by daily or weekly injections of some enzyme, and hopefully we can welcome a new era where you might have a one-shot therapeutic that permanently repairs the causative mutation and permanently reverses the symptoms in patients living with that disease. I think that's the kind of the holy grail of the dream that we could be working towards in the healthcare arena.
We've been speaking with Dr. Samuel Sternberg, assistant professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biophysics at Columbia University and co-author of A Crack in Creation with Dr. Jennifer Doudna. You can learn more about his work by going to shsternberg.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at @shsternberg. Also, you can see him present his latest findings at this year's JAX Health Forum, Dr. Ed Liu's shop here in Farmington, Connecticut, on October 24th and 25th. Sam, thank you for sharing your exciting and pioneering work in this growing field and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks, Mark. And Margaret, it's a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump touted, quote, record business for new health insurance plans under a federal rule that hasn't yet gone into effect. In fact, since at least December 2017, he has periodically and prematurely boasted that millions of people are already signing up for these association health plans. The federal rule pertaining to those plans takes effect August 20th, and it doesn't start applying to association plans until September 1st. At a July 26 roundtable discussion in Iowa, the president singled out Labor Secretary Alex Acosta, whose department is responsible for the new rule on association health plans. He said he heard there had been record business and incredible numbers for plans that he said, quote, just opened about 2 months ago. Association health plans are created by a group of employers, such as those in a similar industry. The Labor Department has been working on a new federal rule to expand and change the regulation of these plans and issued its final rule on June 19. The final rule, though, says it won't begin applying to association plans until September 1st. Yet the president has been talking about millions of people signing up for these plans for months. For example, at a rally in North Dakota in June, Trump said that, quote, millions and millions of people are signing up. Now, it's quite possible that millions of people will eventually sign up for these plans under the new regulations. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated in May that the then proposed rule would result in about 4 million people joining association plans starting in 2023. Avalere Health estimated that the proposed rule would cause 2.4 million to 4.3 million people over 5 years to move to association plans. Under the new rule, associations could form for those in the same trade or industry or for businesses in the same state or metropolitan area. They would need to have at least one business purpose unrelated to providing insurance. Provided couldn't deny coverage or charge more based on health status, but they wouldn't have to cover the 10 essential health benefits the Affordable Care Act requires of plans on the small group and individual market, and these association plans could price plans based on age, gender, or occupation. So the plans could be cheaper than other options on the individual market, but they could offer more limited benefits. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's estimated that a majority of a person's lifelong health expenditures are often spent in the final months of life. But death is one of those topics that generates the least amount of conversation in the clinical setting in American healthcare. For folks who end up critically ill or facing a terminal diagnosis like late-stage cancer, this can often lead to poorly communicated end-of-life wishes being discussed with the clinician, who then often resorts to extreme interventions.
In oncology, you know, notoriously, we are underprepared to have these conversations with patients. There's a desire to want to provide patients with truth. However, there's this unspoken misconception that by having honest conversations about prognosis, that we are somehow removing the hope that patients are coming to us looking for. And actually, most studies have shown that when you provide honest prognostic information to patients and allow patients to be part of the decision-making about their goals of care, they are more appreciative of it and actually have more understanding of their disease process and better satisfaction with their care overall.
Dr. Manali Patel is a clinical researcher at Stanford University School of Medicine. She sought to find interventions that might give clinicians and families a more useful tool to address this gap in communication. Her earlier research had yielded an interesting finding. Patients felt more comfortable talking about end-of-life issues with a layperson as opposed to a clinician. She and her fellow researchers followed patients at the Veterans Administration Palo Alto Healthcare System for 15 months after they were diagnosed with stage 3 or 4 or recurrent cancer. Half the people were randomly assigned to speak with a lay worker about the goals of care over a six-month period. The control group was given no such intervention, and the lay workers were given a rigorous 80-hour course and clinical observations before being assigned to the study.
We found that she learned as she went, and at the end, she was completely proficient. She came to that realization that these conversations really are not scary and shouldn't be medicalized, and maybe she didn't need all that training to begin with. We had hired her specifically because of her service orientation and because she had a very supportive ear. And that's really the main crux of this intervention, was finding the right person who can engage in these conversations without needing a lot of training to do so.
92% of the participants who received the layperson intervention, compared to only 18% of the control group, were likely to have end-of-life directives in their electronic health record and more likely to have communicated their wishes to their clinicians as well, often choosing hospice over emergency room interventions as their conditions deteriorated. The health costs of both groups varied as well. The average cost of care for the intervention group in the last month of life was about $1,000 versus $23,000 for the control group. Dr. Patel said one of the more interesting findings was much higher patient satisfaction among those who'd received the intervention.
We found that the satisfaction scores went up for the patients in the intervention arm, but they went down for patients in the control arm, as well as the satisfaction with decision making. Across all six scores of the satisfaction with decision scale, we found overwhelmingly that the patients in the intervention arm were very satisfied with the decisions that they had made regarding their medical treatments and regarding their life, but the patients in the control arm really did not have much movement at all in terms of how satisfied they were at the beginning of the cancer diagnosis.
The results are published in this month's JAMA Oncology, a low-resource, compassionate, patient-centered intervention that assists terminally ill patients, their families, and their clinicians to have a frank discussion about end-of-life wishes, improving patient satisfaction at such a sensitive and challenging time, and saving significant costs as well. That's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University. streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.